Dick Cheney, who was the vice president at the time, had a pacemaker, and he had it removed because he was so fearful of a terrorist attack. Impact, if somebody hacks in a medical device, can be severe. I mean, you can kill somebody.
Hello, and welcome to episode 67 of the MedTech Podcast. You join me, your host, Karandeep Singh Badwell. And in this episode, we have Christian Espinoza, founder and CEO of Blue Goat Cyber, a company specializing in all types of medical device cybersecurity testing. Christian is a leading medical device cybersecurity expert who started his career within the United States Air Force as a computer systems officer and now is a serial entrepreneur, best-selling author, avid adventurer, and Ironman triathlete. In this episode, we delve into the vital necessity of safeguarding medical devices to avert potential harm or fatalities stemming from hacking. We cover the significance of initially designing devices with security in mind and advocating for ongoing monitoring throughout their lifespan. Furthermore, Christian offers valuable insights for companies on effectively integrating cybersecurity from the outset of development. Welcome to the show, Christian. How are you today?
I'm doing awesome. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. So the interesting world of cybersecurity in medical devices. So to start off with, how exactly did you get involved in this space?
I started in this space in 2014 with my first cybersecurity company. This one is my second one. And we got a contract with a big manufacturer, medical device manufacturer in the St. Louis area. And then I've been doing it ever since then.
Excellent. So in terms of cybersecurity within medical devices, what is it about medical devices that drawn you towards that industry?
There's a couple things. One of them is the risk is much greater. The impact, if somebody hacks in a medical device, can be severe. I mean, you can kill somebody. So I want to do my part in helping healthcare continue to advance. I've done a lot of work with other industries, like if someone hacks in and steals your credit card information or your health information, you know, it's an inconvenience, but it's not as significant. And I always think, like, what if my grandmother is on a hospital and on average there's 14 medical devices connected to a patient or a hospital bed? If somebody hacks into, like, let's say the drug infusion pump, increases the flow rate of some drug she's on and kills her, that has dire consequences. And Last year or 2 years ago, I had blood clots in my left leg, and they're able to diagnose them fairly quickly. So I survived. So that's another reason I want to continue helping these advances with these devices move forward and not be rolled back because of some sort of cyber attack.
So when it comes to cybersecurity, and feel free to agree with me on this one as well, it's kind of a lot of people often have a lot of misconceptions about cybersecurity in terms of what it is. Would you be willing to discuss what those misconceptions are that you come across in your work?
Well, I think the industry as a whole in cybersecurity has done a poor job communicating what it's really about, and they've overly complicated it with a lot of acronyms and unnecessary terminology. Cybersecurity is ultimately about reducing risk. There's always going to be risk involved with anything you do. And in terms of a technology or software, cybersecurity its main purpose is to reduce the risk of a vulnerability being exploited either intentionally by a malicious hacker or unintentionally by the user, just erroneously. So it's really about reducing the risk to an acceptable level.
So when it comes to cybersecurity on medical devices, a lot of people think of only software medical devices or devices that are actively attached to the internet world of, the Internet of Things. Would you perhaps give any examples of where traditional devices require cybersecurity?
By traditional, you mean they're not connected to the internet?
Or maybe people don't perceive that they're connected to the internet. So for example, I've heard of some cases where pacemakers may be connected to the internet and people don't realize.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So implantables like pacemakers, that's a good example. They're not connected to the internet, most of them, but they have to be updated periodically, the firmware in the pacemaker or the implantable. And we have to get diagnostic data off of it. So the way to do that is through some sort of wireless connection. And it's typically like Bluetooth, for instance. And there for a while, pacemakers were a big concern. I know in the United States, Dick Cheney, who was the vice president at the time, had a pacemaker, and he had it removed because he was so fearful of a terrorist attack, because there's a vulnerability where you could remotely, from a fair distance, connect to the pacemaker and cause it to just continually shock somebody over and over and over and ultimately kill them. So he had his removed because of that threat. And a lot of these areas that have come up, or these challenges that have come up, these vulnerabilities, have really focused the FDA and the EU MDR and other organizations to really become more stringent on the cybersecurity requirements for any medical device. Because a lot of devices we think might be self-contained may have a wireless connection, like that Bluetooth one, which can be easily exploited.
So it's an interesting one. You may mention that pacemakers are connected via Bluetooth or via the internet, but what is being done to perhaps try and reduce that potential risk of these kind of things happening?
What's being done is, during the design phase of the product and throughout the life cycle, it has to be continuously monitored and tested and made sure it was designed securely to begin with. And that's what my company does, is we help manufacturers get their devices approved through the FDA or the EU MDR. And often the challenge, though, is that the manufacturer comes to us really late in the game, where it requires a lot of rework because they've already coded a lot of things, but they've coded them erroneously or with errors that somebody could exploit.
As a regulatory professional, I can very much agree with you on that one. They come to us very late, and then often we have to go back and do things in retrospective, which of course doesn't, of course, work. So what can companies start doing from the get-go? So for example, if there's a startup company, or maybe if somebody's got an idea for a medical device, what's maybe something that they can start thinking of in-house to make sure that they start off on the right foot?
I think they can start looking at how to design the device securely at the beginning. What, like you alluded to, what typically happens is people wait till the device is almost finished and then try to like bolt on some security versus design it into the device. And one way to do that is you can go to the OWASP, O-W-A-S-P. They have a DevSecOps, it's Development Security and Operations Guideline, that tells you how to develop software securely and how to test it while you're developing it at various stages in your CI/CD pipeline. So that's a way of developing the software securely, which will ultimately cost you less than having to redo a bunch of things later when it's tested by a cybersecurity professional.
So when it comes to cybersecurity, there's often a few methods such as Stride, and there's a few others out there as well. What is the right method for a company, or would you say it's more dependent on the product and what the claims are?
I think Stride is a decent threat model method. That's what we use. Ultimately, though, what you have to do is dial in your threat model and understand the trust boundary of the system or the medical device, and then all the entry points into that device, and then look at the model, such as Stride or Dread or Pasta. It doesn't really matter, in my opinion. Look at all the attacks and vectors into the entry point. And the entry point could be a bug in the software. It could be a Bluetooth interface. It could be an RFID interface. It could be a USB interface. It could be a connection to the internet, a wired connection. It could be the mobile app that the device sends data to. It could be the cloud system that the device communicates with. So there's all these different things that have to be really scrutinized and look at every single way somebody could try to get in through that attack entry point, and then what they can do if they do get in, which is where the Stride comes in. Can they spoof information? Can they tamper with it? Et cetera. Can they alter the integrity, which is really a big deal with medical devices? If you can alter the integrity, which could cause a misdiagnosis or the device to do something it wasn't intended to do.
So following on from that, what would you say are some of the lesser known entry points for a cybersecurity attack? I find some companies can get very extreme on one side and often leave the littlest of things unseen, and then that leaves them open to an attack.
Yeah, I think the less common entry points that people don't think about are, at least what we discover, are typically problematic, are something as simple as a touchscreen. Like in 80% of the cases were able to bypass the touchscreen and get into the device as administrator or root level access. So that people just assume it's in kiosk mode, it's going to be secure. That's one. And then Bluetooth often is unsecure in devices, and we're able to get into the device via Bluetooth as well, or intercept traffic between the device and an application and alter the traffic before it goes to the application. So those are a couple ways, and even RFID. We did a device recently where it had some RFID vulnerabilities, and we were able to alter the data through the RFID.
So another point of cybersecurity, of course, is somewhat of a regulatory requirement. You know, if you create a medical device, you need to do some sort of cybersecurity work on it. A lot of companies often confuse to what extent should they take that? What is the level of testing? You know, what's your recommendation that companies should go to in terms of making that decision?
Well, the level of testing should be to the highest degree of scrutiny and due diligence. I mean, these devices, some of them are life-sustaining devices. So the risk is super high. It's not like someone stealing your credit card information, like I mentioned earlier. It's somebody could die. And if this device is attacked globally, then multiple patients can die. So it's important to really do your due diligence. And the FDA in the United States came out with new guidance in September that really tightened the reins in cybersecurity. A lot of organizations kind of squeaked things through before then to get them on the market. But after that guidance, a lot of device manufacturers were getting deficiency reports from the FDA because they weren't doing the adequate due diligence on cybersecurity. And then when they come to us and we help them address those deficiencies, ideally, you know, they would have done that beforehand.
In terms of deficiencies with the FDA or even with the EU, what are the common ones that you see when people put their technical file submission in there? You know, what are the common ones that companies make the mistake on?
One of the most common ones is an insufficient threat model. Like we kind of talked about the trust boundary, the entry points, and all the things somebody can do if you apply Stride to each interface. That's one of the most common. People either ignore the threat model or they don't understand what needs to go in a threat model. Another one is not having a software bill of materials. That's a requirement now. The software bill of materials is a list of all the open source software that makes up your software. And that way, if there's a problem with an open source piece of code, a library from an open source provider, and that's announced, then you know that code is in your software. So that's a big one. And then another one is a lot of people try to do their own testing. Like some organizations will do their own vulnerability and penetration testing. And typically you want to have a third party do that. It's generally not a good idea to have the person that wrote the device or the team that wrote the code for the device do the testing themselves on the device. It's a conflict of interest. And then probably another one is traceability. In cybersecurity, traceability is extremely important. So if we find a vulnerability and we mitigate it, what is the control that reduces the risk of that vulnerability? And how do we trace that control back to a software change, a hardware modification, a constraint interface? It doesn't really matter, but we have to have the traceability for all those things that are discovered so we know what the actual risk is for the device.
So having worked with a lot of software medical device manufacturers which are connected, I'm finding often they miss the cybersecurity part when it comes to their design controls and their changings. Have you seen that too?
100%. They typically don't consider cybersecurity to the very end. And they're like, oh no, the FDA has all these cybersecurity requirements, or the EU MDR does, and we need some help in our submission is going to be in a month when they call us and like, it's going to take at least 2 months. And they get a little bit upset about it, but it's better, much better to do the cybersecurity and any of the regulatory stuff sooner than later in the process.
So once a company's obviously contacted you and done their cybersecurity report, at which point would they maybe have to consider making updates to that? Is it maybe when they make a software change? Is it more a significant change? Is it when new risks are recognized? At what point should they decide that we need to do testing again?
So typically when a company comes to us, a manufacturer, the longest part of the process is how long it takes them to fix the things we identified. So we do our testing, we give them an initial report with all the things they need to fix, and that is the longest part in the process because they weren't anticipating all those things. They thought their code or their software as a medical device was relatively secure. And then we tell them otherwise, and they have to fix everything. And then the whole idea is we keep these iterations going on. They fix stuff, we test again, they fix stuff, we test again, until we get the risk down to an acceptable level for patient safety and for the submission. And then after the device is on the market, as you know, there's post-market management that has to be done. So we continuously look for new vulnerabilities that come up or a new exploit against an existing vulnerability that comes up that could affect this device. And then if that comes up, the device needs to be updated and that vulnerability needs to be addressed. So it's a continuous thing. It's not like one and done. And then even if a vulnerability hasn't been discovered, the device should at least be tested once a year while it's in the field. Another penetration test, another vulnerability assessment, because there's always new tools coming out. There's always new threats, and there's new tactics and techniques and procedures that testers use.
So as the world is becoming more digitalized, especially with medical devices as well, now, you know, there's a lot more at-home testing rather than having to go into a clinic. What can maybe the consumers, the people at home, the users of the medical devices start doing to perhaps protect themselves from cybersecurity attacks?
Well, one of the requirements now is more detailed cybersecurity labeling for each device. So you get the device that has the documentation about the risk and everything about the device from a cybersecurity perspective. So you, as a consumer, should understand the risk and what to do and what to look for if there's a risk. So I think the consumer should read that guidance so they're aware of some of the cybersecurity risks. They're aware of what the software is in that device. And something as simple as like a tamper-proof seal, for instance, that's typically included in labeling. If they notice the seal is broken, they should assume the device has been compromised. If they know the device has Bluetooth, they might want to just be cautious of where they're using the device because there's obviously attacks on Bluetooth.
So you mentioned Bluetooth quite a lot. Would you feel as though this is more of an outdated technology, or would you feel as though there's a way to improve it and continue using it in the foreseeable future?
I feel there's a way to improve it, and I feel like it's relatively secure if it's configured properly. Like with any of these technologies, the challenge is a lot of people think they have them configured properly, but from an attacker perspective, there's one setting that isn't correct, and we can still get into the device. Like we can pair with that device, we can intercept the traffic if it's not encrypted properly, and things of that nature.
So what would you say are maybe some of the devices out there that people don't realize are sort of vulnerable to cybersecurity attacks? For example, I know from a past conversation, you mentioned surgical robotics. People may not realize that these devices are connected, especially when it comes to things like, you know, telemedicine, et cetera. Would you be able to discuss on that point?
Yeah, surgical robots, we've tested those before. Right now, they're driven by a physician or the doctor or the surgeon. Those have had vulnerabilities, pretty major vulnerabilities. And if you have a surgical robot that is assisting in surgery on your back, for instance, and that device is compromised, then, you know, you could really hurt somebody severely or even kill them. And the challenge I think we have now is we're moving away from a surgeon that's required to operate the bot to, you know, the future is autonomous bots. So you go in and have surgery and this robot just does it without the assistance of anybody. And that is opening up a slew of issues in cybersecurity because the risk is much greater if somebody can't just intervene and stop that that bot if it's compromised. So that's a big one. And we've tested a lot of different things, a lot of devices like IVD devices, IDAST devices. And a lot of these devices have had major flaws. One of them, for instance, is a device that tests your blood to determine what bacteria you have in your blood, and then it recommends an antibiotic. That device we've tested, one of them, had a lot of vulnerabilities. So if you have sepsis, for instance, you run a sample of your blood through the device and it's been compromised, it could say you don't have sepsis and then you can die. And because your blood is toxic at that point. And these same devices are used in industry as well to test things like hamburger. So hamburger has to be tested for E. coli, for salmonella. And if you can taint the hamburger stream to introduce E. coli into hamburger, compromises device, it tests negative for E. coli, even though it does have E. coli. The hamburger sold to McDonald's and Burger King and everywhere else, you know, children and older people can die from that E. coli. So those are a couple devices. Another one that's probably a lot of people don't think about that we've tested is like with LASIK surgery, your eye is never fully still. It's moving. And there's technology that tracks the movement of your eye, so laser cuts in the right spot. That device, one of those devices, has had a major vulnerability where we could alter the algorithm of it tracking your eye movement, and it could cut, the laser could cut random holes in your eye, for instance. So there's a lot of things we probably don't consider that are, you know, medical devices that have vulnerabilities that have been resolved.
So for the younger audience today who may be looking to start their studies or maybe get a career within cybersecurity, where do you think are the ideal areas of which they should focus on?
Well, a career in cybersecurity is a broad topic. So if they want to look at testing, I think it's in medical device testing, for instance, I think finding a way to learn embedded testing, embedded cybersecurity would be the best thing. Also, getting familiar with what a SBOM is, a software bill of materials, what tools you can use for that, and then also getting familiar with DevSecOps and OWASP, as we mentioned. OWASP is a really good resource, OWASP.org. They have an embedded system testing guide. They have IoT testing guides and documentation on how to develop devices securely as well and software securely.
So in terms of starting your own business, obviously you started this, how did that journey go for you? Was this the first time that you got into business, or would you consider yourself a serial entrepreneur?
I would consider myself a serial entrepreneur. This is my second business, second cybersecurity business. I have other businesses. I built and sold the first one. I sold it in 2020. And then I worked for the parent company for a while. And then I started this one. I was going to get out of cybersecurity, but I felt like all the things I messed up and, you know, had to pay the dumb tax for on my first business, hopefully the next business will go much better. There's always stuff you're going to mess up and stuff you have to learn, but it is going much better. And I've niched it down to focus on medical device cybersecurity. In my first business, I try to do everything in cybersecurity. And when you try to do everything for everyone, you've got a diluted message and you don't really have any prospects knocking at your door. So now I'm focused on medical device cybersecurity. My team is specialized in that. Our messaging is all about that. And that's our ideal client, medical device manufacturers.
So I'm aware that you started your career within the United States Air Force, and I was in the British Royal Air Force myself for a few years. Do you feel as though the skills and the traits that you learned from the Air Force has helped you build your business in terms of where it is today?
I think the discipline from the military and the leadership skills I acquired have certainly helped me with business. I would say those are the two main ones. And just how to run an organization and how to create a culture as well.
So I know you're a very busy man when it comes to cybersecurity and running your own business, of course, but I also know you're very interesting in terms of you've written quite a few books, you do triathlons, you've skydived, you also mentioned that you're into Formula One. So what exactly are you getting up to outside of work?
I took some time off from training, so I started running again recently. So I'm training for a triathlon. I'm not sure I'm going to commit to one this year. As I mentioned a couple years ago, I had a blood clot, so it's been a long journey to like reclaim my health. I am going to the F1 race in Monaco this year, which would be a fun trip. I've never been to Monaco. And I'm also going to the one in Abu Dhabi. And then actually tonight I'm leaving to go to Boston for a medical device conference. And there is an F1 simulator in Boston. So I booked two slots so I can do the simulator race. It's like the official F1 simulator where you have the real steering wheel, the seat moves, and you know, you can drive, I think, Silverstone and Spa. Those are a couple of the tracks. So that should be fun.
I think as an entrepreneur, of course, there has to be a balance. It's very easy to be working, you know, 16-hour days, 7 days a week, and you start neglecting your health mm-hmm. and other activities. But what would you say are some of the things that you do to keep yourself in shape and keep your mind sharp to ensure that your business runs smoothly?
Yeah, I don't know if I'm the best at that, because as of like January until the end of March, I probably worked 15 hours a day every day. And I was hyper-focused to, you know, do search engine optimization, get our processes dialed in, all of that, get our sales process dialed in, our delivery systems dialed in, our team dialed in. And I can only do that for so long, though. So now I've got some breathing room. What I'll do is if I have a break between meetings, I might do some push-ups, you know, just something to get my blood flowing, go for a walk outside. And do things like realize it's okay to take some time off, like do that F1 simulator in Boston, for instance. Because if I would have continued on the path I was on, like the 15 hours a day every day, I would have burned myself out. I could only do that for so long. You know, and that balance is extremely important, because at the end of the day, there's always a bigger goal to chase. There's always, you know, more revenue. There's always more clients. There's always more people to hire. And if you get in that cycle, sometimes it's hard to get out of it. You have to step back and realize that life is here right in front of me, not necessarily on the distant horizon.
I often find the mistake with first-time entrepreneurs is they try to do everything themselves, the website building, the SEOs, rather than just focus on what they're really good at. How would you say that you first overcame that issue in terms of, you know, hiring people or outsourcing some of that work?
Yeah, that was a hard thing for me to overcome in my first company, because, you know, I did do everything. I did the accounting, the website, the testing myself, the sales, you know, all of it, the marketing. And I was good at all of it because it's my company. I had the drive, the necessity, the motivation, the why, all of that. And then when I started hiring people, I would get frustrated because they couldn't do things as fast as I could do them. And then I realized, you know, this is a flawed mindset, because I can't scale if I'm always doing everything. And I had to tell myself, if I have two people that can do something 60% as good as me, that's still 120% over my 100%. And if I have three people, you know, that's 180%. So I have to look at it from that perspective, that my team might not be able to do these certain things faster than me, but without my team, I'm limited on my growth. There's an African proverb that says, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go the team.
So Christian, what exactly is your long-term vision? Of course, there's going to be a time where you're not going to have to pack in the business, or maybe, you know, sell it on. What exactly is your end-term goal with it?
So I want to set the business up and grow it. I want to become the market leader in medical device cybersecurity. That's my goal. And as far as like exiting the business, I don't necessarily have a plan to sell the business. I do have a plan to get the business in a state that it is super sellable, though. I think from a selling appeal to someone, if somebody wants to buy your business, you have to have recurring revenue. You have to have processes in place. You have to have maybe a technology in place. You have to have certain things that make the business appealing to a potential buyer. And my goal is to have all those things in place because all those things make your business run much smoother anyway and make you much more able to scale. And I have, at some point in the future, I have a choice. I can either just be an owner of the business and it runs by itself, or I can sell the business to another company, or I can try to take the business public. You know, those are like the three options. And I'm just trying to set myself up so like 4 years down the road or 5 years down the road, those options, I'll have the ability to execute either one of those I want to.
What would you say is your best software or time-saving tool that you found in your experience?
I don't know if I have a best software or time-saving tool. I use Asana and things like that for task management. But I think the best thing I've done to maximize my time is what I call monotasking, which is the opposite of multitasking, which is focusing on one thing with concentrated effort for like an hour block. So in my calendar, I'm very pretty religious with my calendar. I'll put a block of time in there and treat it like a meeting. So even if the block of time is for me to like work on my book, I treat that as a meeting with somebody else, which I wouldn't miss anyway, and I work on my book for that hour, and that's all I do. That means I don't check my email during the hour, I don't check my text messages, I don't check Slack. And the reason that is because every time you multitask, you're horribly inefficient, and you're very busy but not very productive because you're always context switching between one task and another one, and I've broken the habit of multitasking and focus purely on the tasks that matter, so I'm more productive. And I think that's the other critical thing as an entrepreneur or in life is to prioritize your day and say, what are the big things I need to get done today? Like, what are the top two I need to get done today? Not the top 100. Like, if what are the top two? And then schedule the time in your day, the block of time to monotask on those top two. Otherwise, your day will be overcome by circumstances and other people's demands.
So Christian, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. What one piece of advice would you be leaving the listeners with today?
In terms of what context are we looking for?
Any context you like.
All right, cool. I think the advice I would leave, or the advice I will leave, is I believe we all have innate wisdom. We know what we want to do. We have an inner voice that tells us a lot of what we should avoid and what we should go after. But throughout our life, we've sort of like tuned out of it. And I think it's important to silence the noise, all the distractions, and tune into yourself. You can do it just through meditation, or you can just do it through silence, however you do it. And then follow the voice inside your head, what it's telling you to do, decision-wise, career-wise, anything. Because when I've actually tuned in myself and listen to that voice, it's always been right. When I've ignored the voice and tried to like logically reason to do something else, it's been wrong. So that would be my advice, to tune into yourself, silence the noise, and then pay attention.
Thank you very much for your time, Christian.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Thank you for listening to episode 67 of the MedTech Podcast. If you have not already done so, please subscribe. If you wish to learn more about Christian, you can connect with him online or visit his company website, the links of which are provided in the description. If there are any particular topics or guests you would like for me to have on the show in future, then feel free to reach out.